Well, in 1965, a 22-year-old American student activist called Paul Potter wrote the following words. He said, "The incredible war in Vietnam has provided the razor, the terrifying, sharp, cutting edge that has finally severed the last vestige of illusion that morality and democracy are the guiding principles of American foreign policy." And in 1965, and for many years afterwards, tens of thousands of students and young workers and people across the globe agreed with him. They felt that the war in Vietnam, with all of the images that were spilling out across the world of children burned by napalm, of villages destroyed by Agent Orange, of a whole country devastated by bombs and destruction, that had revealed to them the underlying reality of what American empire and what the American state was actually about. The Vietnam War was undeniably the political and moral question of a generation. And I'm sure many of us feel exactly the same about the war on Gaza, that it has revealed for us all to see the deep and structural horrific reality of what capitalism in the 20th and 21st century has in store for us. So I wanted to talk tonight about some of the realities of 21st century capitalism and what we can look to in the future as to what it might actually provide for us. Firstly, I think what the war on Gaza has actually revealed is that capitalism is a very brutal system. In school or in lots of popular media, we're sort of taught about many of the historic horrors of the 20th century. So many of us grew up learning about the mustard gas of World War I, or the trenches, or the many, many varied horrors of the destruction of European cities or the concentration camps of World War II. But to the extent that these imperialist wars are kind of discussed much, the brutalities are often kind of taught as a necessary part of the kind of construction of a nation. They're often taught as though they're part of a kind of wonderful history, a glorious history, in fact, of patriotism, of nationalism, or they're kind of taught as though they were aberrations of some kind of 20th century mania. You know, we're often taught, and I've just been reading actually many of the high school and primary school textbooks that talk about World War I. And this event that of Gallipoli, when you actually read about the reality of what Gallipoli was the massacre of over 7,000 young men, the age of many people in this room, the age of 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old young men who were thrust onto a beach in a country they had no idea what they were there for, and they were massacred, they were gunned down. And how was this history discussed in textbooks? It was the beginning of mateship. It was the establishment of Australianism. Aren't we all wonderfully grateful for this kind of moment of, you know, Australian glory where blood spilled on the beaches of Gallipoli? And we're supposed to be grateful for that. The horrors of the concentration camps are often explained away as complete aberrations. They're just the result of the kind of hypnotic personality of Hitler or the particular quirks of German nationalism. And I think all of these things fit together. There's this really dominant idea, in the West at least, that these were all phenomena of the past and that we can feel really comfortable that society has evolved, that a lot of things have changed. And I think Gaza, if it has done nothing else, has blown that idea completely out of the water. There is no way now that anyone can pretend that the brutality of the system and of capitalism is a thing of the past. Yeah. It is now. So I'm sure we all have many different moments where that's been brought home to us. It's been, you know, the last 6 months, I have to say, has been one of the most desperate, outraging series of months that I have ever lived through in my life. You know, we've seen just image after image, you know, whether it's the images of little Hind, who many of us would know as the small girl who was stuck in a car for over 48 hours, seeing her parents murdered in front of her, and then the people who she was calling out for, the medical staff that she was calling out for to be helping her, also murdered in front of her. And then for that to be her last images. Her last memories on this world were of the death of everyone around her. Those kind of images come home to us tonight, and over the course of the last 6 months, we've been waking up to all of them. Many of us will have seen the massacres that occurred at Al-Shifa Hospital, seen the discussions from medical staff, and not just Palestinian medical staff, but American staff, French staff, British doctors and nurses who went over there to try and help and discovered the absolute horror that was in front of them and unfolding on a daily basis. But for me, it's been the kind of little moments. For instance, I helped chair one of the last demonstrations that happened in Perth just a couple of weeks ago. And we had a speaker from Gaza who was talking about, from the stage, you know, revealing for everyone in Perth to kind of hear about the fact that a number of his cousins had been murdered just that day by the Israeli military war machine. And as he was saying that, the co-chair, a Palestinian woman, leaned over and said in quite a matter-of-fact voice, just kind of whispering quite quietly, she said, "Vashti, as he's speaking, you should also know that I just got a message that my sister has just lost her eyesight because she hasn't had enough to eat for the last week." And it's just, it's beyond belief, you know, and I'm sure we all have many, many stories that are very similar, that absolutely kind of bring home to bear the horror of what we're seeing in front of us. But I think all of this, again, is not just about the horrors of today. I think we need to also understand that what we're seeing unfold in front of us in Gaza is also about the future. In November of last year, one of the killers who took part in the 1948 massacre of Palestinians in the infamous village of Deir Yassin, a military figure called Ezra Yaqin, he was actually sent to speak to some of the Israeli brigades that were entering Gaza. And it was reported by Israeli media in quite glowing terms that he gave a very rousing speech to the troops. And a number of the kind of major news outlets of the day printed in part some of what his speech said, and this is what it said. To the troops that were about to go into Gaza, he said, "Go and murder. Erase the memories of families, mothers, and children." And that kind of project, that kind of attempt at complete destruction, not just physical destruction, but emotional, political, social, and cultural destruction of an entire group of people. For many people across the world, we've been calling this ethnic cleansing. We've been rightly calling it genocide. But I think comments like Yaqin's also reveal the degree to which the butchers in the Israeli military and all of those forces that support them, and again, I think we need to include, as both May and Haider did, all of the butchers in the Australian and American governments, they do not just have today in mind, they also have the future in mind. They want to send a signal. So this war is not just about today, it is also about tomorrow. And it brings to mind a quote from the Auschwitz survivor and novelist Primo Levi. And he said, "It did not matter that they might die along the way. What really mattered was that they should not live to tell their story." And so the murder and the destruction in Gaza, it's designed to reshape the world to come. And that reshaping requires the erasure of memory. It requires the obliteration of humanity, and not just for now, but for generations. And that is the Zionist project, make no mistake about it. And it's a project which is fundamentally steeped in capitalist colonization and in modern day imperialism. And so we haven't moved on to a society where rationality solves everything, where the pen is mightier than the sword. Brutality, murder, war, and violence, these are not part of society's past. They are part and parcel of capitalism's now and future. And I want to come back again a little bit later to talk about what our rulers have in store for us. But before I do, I want to come to hypocrisy, because it is a very big theme of the last 6 months. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of Mahatma Gandhi, as many people could perhaps guess, but he did occasionally have quite a pithy and incisive way with words. And In the 1940s, he was doing an interview with a British journalist, and in kind of classic, not quite Socratic form, but, you know, these journalists, very smug journalists, were kind of suggesting that the Indian anti-colonial movement had kind of, you know, they'd lost the plot a bit. They were kind of, you know, going a bit too far. And didn't Gandhi appreciate all of the kind of wonderful things that British colonialism had brought to India? You know, not famine, not disaster and destruction, obviously, but the railways, the roads, running water. Wasn't it all quite glorious? And at the conclusion of this kind of argument, this journalist said to Gandhi point blank, so what do you think about Western civilization after I've kind of made all these you know, wonderful arguments? And Gandhi said, I think it would be a very good idea. And that quote, and I kind of like to say it a lot because it really kind of cuts to the heart of so much of what we're seeing across the world today. You know, in reality, for many, many people across the world, the mask has absolutely been ripped from the realities of global capitalism. Western civilization has been revealed to be what it is. And I've just completely lost my pages here. Give me a second. Because I think what Gaza has done, it's really exposed not just the brutality of the system, but also much of the kind of hypocrisy that lies at the heart of it. And so just as we've been really encouraged to believe that brutality is merely part of kind of society's history and not of today, we've also really been encouraged to believe that the West is the regulator of a rational, rules-based order. We've been led to believe that our world is governed by many different checks and balances, by very reliable institutions, by courts of law, by investigations, by commissions, by royal commissions sometimes, if we get that far, that if there's a wrong committed somewhere, that there will be someone reliable and responsible, probably dressed in a uniform, who will deal with it well and rationally and will put it right. And again, I think Gaza has really smashed these ideas. The centre of Western enlightenment and democracy, the United States, far from regulating and restraining Israel's slaughter in Gaza, has been greenlighting it. And we all know many of the details about all of this. We've learned through the entire process the difference, the very fundamental and significant difference between words and actions. So above the table, these Western leaders, Genocide Joe, chief amongst them, have declared that Israel should limit civilian casualties. But under the table, the purse is permanently open. And so for all of the talk of a rules-based order, the United States has quietly approved and delivered more than 100 separate foreign military sales to Israel since the Gaza war began. And we can kind of talk about that and we can kind of engage in collective shaming. But I think if we actually stop and think what that means, you know, and if you actually look and read about the details of what is moving from Americans' hands into the Israeli military forces, you get a picture of just the degree to which the Western state and all of the Western order is complicit, and not just complicit, is actually bombing and killing Palestinians on the ground. So what this amounts to, these 100 separate foreign military sales, it amounts to over 1,000 precision-guided munitions. It amounts to small diameter bombs. It amounts to bunker busters and over 1,000 small arms. And that's just what's happening in public. In December, so this is 2 months or 3 months, my maths isn't wonderful, after the war began, the Biden administration actually wanted to expand. It was revealed by a variety of different investigations, journalistic investigations, that the Biden administration decided that far from pulling back from their support for Israel, they actually wanted to expand their support for Israel under the table through secret and backdoor means. And so the Guardian actually revealed that somewhere inside of Israel, they don't know exactly where it is, but there are multiple closely guarded warehouses that contain billions of dollars worth of weapons owned by the United States government that have been sitting there since the 1980s, you know, waiting to be used by one of their favourite states in the world, the Israeli state. And in response to some investigatory kind of questioning by journalists and so on to this revelation, a former Pentagon senior official said the following. He said, "Officially, it's US equipment for US use. But on the other hand, in an emergency, who's to say that we're not going to give them, Israel, the keys to the warehouse?" And what has been revealed is that the keys were cut for Israel. They were distributed and they were put on all of the key rings of the major Israeli purveyors of genocide. And so since the war began, I feel like I've kind of read an absolutely ridiculous number of extremely smug and confident kind of liberal think pieces, mainly published in the New York Times, by journalists explaining how the United States' kind of unwavering support and Joe Biden's unwavering support in this moment is a result of his kind of personal commitment to Zionism. I'm sure everyone's kind of read these pieces about how Genocide Joe went and visited Israel and met Golda Meir, the former Prime Minister of Israel, and that just had this profound impact on Joe Biden that just affected him to his core, and he was so moved by this history that he just can't get beyond it, and there's this deep kind of psychological explanation for all of this kind of vast amount of military and political support. And also, I mean, this is just a kind of a side note, but all of these articles always describe Golda Meir is trailblazing, which is just vile, who's one of, you know, it's like it was wonderful that she was this kind of trailblazing female war criminal, and this was kind of, just a great moment for kind of girl power across the world. And this is the woman, again, kind of digress slightly, but, you know, this was an actual quote from Golda Meir. She said in 1973, after the 1973 war, she said, "We hate the Palestinians for what they make our boys do to them." Yeah, just absolutely sickening. Anyway, you know, this is the figure who is said to kind of inspire Joe Biden so much. And, you know, all of these kind of liberal think pieces and many other similar articles to them talk about how Biden's kind of, he's just a bit of a troglodyte. He's a throwback to an earlier kind of period. He's just an old Cold War warrior who really hasn't kind of caught up with the times. And really all of that is kind of an explanation for why the United States supports Israel. And I would say that all of those explanations are completely infantile. Wars are not conducted and then supported by states because of the personal, emotional histories of particular politicians, or because the leaders of these countries are a bit old school. They're waged, and Israel is backed by the United States, as it has been in reality, despite all of the words, by all the main European and Middle Eastern powers, all of them, down the line, despite words, in reality, backed by them, because Israel is a major plank in the capitalist order in the Middle East. Full stop. That is the reality to the situation now. And Israel, the US's commitment to Israel will not be shaken, as some people have claimed, by getting Biden to meet more Palestinians. In fact, for years, Biden has been holding iftar dinners with Arabs and Palestinians, and I read an article that described the very moving encounter that at just last year's iftar dinner Biden had with the grandmother of Rashida Tlaib, where she talked about her history of life in the West Bank, and apparently some, you know, moving tears kind of creased the aging cheeks of Joe Biden. Undead as he is, he could seem to kind of make some water kind of come out of his body somehow. But, all of that, all of the kind of interpersonal interaction and meeting with Palestinians and understanding the real truth, like, no one in the capitalist class makes a decision about the world and about politics based on an individual kind of experience, and it's certainly not based on some kind of emotional response to the realities of oppression. When the wheels of capitalism grind into gear, all of the liberal institutions, which are said to govern and restrain the system, actually have no power. And so here, just take the International Court of Justice. For all that it laid out Israel's crimes in an absolutely forensic way, forensic and heartbreaking way, its ruling was absolutely incapable of stopping Israel. The United Nations is in the same boat, and much has been made of this kind of last ceasefire motion and so on, and we'll have to see how all of this plays out in the world. But in response, Netanyahu and the other fascists in his government have made absolutely no indication that they're stepping back from the invasion of Rafah, and there will certainly be no justice based on a ceasefire motion like that. And so the reality is that these kind of bodies of international order are incapable, they're structurally incapable of restraining or limiting the excesses of the most powerful capitalist countries in the world if they do not want to be restrained or limited. They have no power. So before finishing, I kind of wanted to return to the point that I made earlier about the future of what kind of 21st century capitalism is offering us. As tonight, last night at the opening session of the conference, Omar kind of made the point that 21st century capitalism looks like a lot more war and a lot more inequality. And I think that is absolutely right. Imperialism, which is this kind of ceaseless, restless, expansive, exploitative system of competition between nations, is such a global theme of politics today. And just as the conflict between the United States and the USSR really dominated the whole and kind of every dynamic and conflict that occurred in the 20th century, so too this conflict that we're seeing emerge around us today of the two major capitalist world powers, China and the United States, are set to dominate this century. And already we've seen in Ukraine the ways in which kind of regional conflicts can come to represent broader imperial tensions. And as a result, more and more countries are becoming more and more heavily militarized. So 2023 alone saw a significant increase in military spending globally, with a rise of 9%, which amounts to a record of $2.2 trillion. $2.2 trillion. I recently managed to save $10,000. Yeah. And that was, yeah. Like to... Thank you all for my, my penny pinching. But, if anyone can imagine what $2.2 trillion might look like and might mean in kind of global terms, let alone kind of personal terms, you should get some sort of medal. But, you know, that is that's the reality of what we're actually talking about here. And Australia, far from, as May said, wanting to be left out of this kind of rush to kind of global power and relevance and military spending, has jumped on board. And we've just passed the year-long anniversary of the signing of the $368 billion AUKUS Pact, which shores up Australia's role as a really major player in the American camp. And, you know, last year, I think Ben Hillier wrote a really wonderful article, and people, if you haven't read it, you should go and read it, in Red Flag newspaper, talking about the ways in which Australian society over the next decade or so would really be transformed by this AUKUS Pact. And, you know, many of us were kind of thinking, oh, well, you know, that's kind of an interesting prediction for the future. Well, the reality of this is that it's already started to have quite a significant impact. In Perth, which is where I live, we've already, just in the last month or so, seen the arrival in the Stirling Naval Base of fast attack nuclear submarines, which have started to be docked there. And as part of this process, which has involved the bringing over of kind of hundreds of American submariners to live and frolic in Perth, as it was kind of described, they're really happy to be there, as many people across the world are just dying to come to Perth, apparently. As part of this, they're on a kind of major, as one newspaper article described it, charm offensive to try and encourage the population, in particular young men of Perth, to consider a future career in the submarining business. One of the Commodores, which is apparently the kind of one of the head honchos of submarining, I guess we'll all learn much more about these kind of terms in the coming period, but he was actually asked in the newspaper, well, why should young people kind of consider a future in joining up the Australian/American kind of military rather than joining, you know, the mines or whatever, where you can go and work and be paid quite a lot. And this Commodore Tom Phillips, replied by saying, well, and I think they need a new PR person, to be honest, but he said this. He said, well, you're putting yourself in harm's way for other people and countries. And that's something I don't know if you can do in other industries. Which was really, like, not, I think probably not the message that they were trying to get across. Like, you could, if you join up with this military, you could go somewhere else and you could get potentially fatally harmed or die. And you don't get to do that in all these other industries. So, awesome. Two thumbs up for that. But, you know, it does kind of point to something I think quite serious, which is increasingly these kind of dynamics are going to be shaping our lives in quite a serious and upfront way over time. And I think we need to be on the alert for that. But while these kind of, you know, submariner jerks are increasingly kind of wandering our streets and cities, and really obscene amounts of cash are being spent on weaponry, the lives of workers are just getting tougher and tougher. And again, this kind of comes back to one of the themes which we started to touch upon last night, and that's what 21st century capitalism has to offer. It's a world where kids in Gaza, if they aren't having their limbs blown off, are being forced to eat donkey feed or grass to survive, and the rich are getting richer. And I was actually, I don't know if people, there's quite a funny Instagram comedian. He does this little bit called "I'm rich and you're poor," which is funny because he's not rich and he is actually poor, so it's satire, which I'm made to understand is a big thing on Instagram amongst young people. In that same week, as Palestinians were getting shot trying to get aid from food trucks and were being massacred for trying to get access to flour, in the same week he had this little bit about rich people in London paying £500, which is $1,000, £500 for an entree meal. And in this entree meal, it wasn't just any entree meal, it was an entree meal which was in a bubble. So the restaurant had gone to all of this way to put a little bubble over this entree, and then they blew some smoke into it, and then all the rich people were kind of sitting around going, isn't this marvellous, you know, wonderful. And for that, they paid $1,000. And at that exact same, and you know, you get, I think over the last 6 months or so, you just have these moments of complete cognitive dissonance. You're kind of going through Instagram or whatever it might be, you see one shot of people in Gaza being massacred for trying to get access to flour, the most basic things in the world, for food. And then the next thing is you have these absolute shits in London blowing smoke into bubbles and paying $500 or £500 for the privilege of doing so. You know, it's just an absolute indictment of the way that the system operates. And it's not by accident. These things happen simultaneously because as the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and those things are fundamentally related. So to conclude, capitalism has to go. The end. No. I mean, that's what this whole conference is kind of fundamentally about. It is about describing the ways in which we live in a deeply violent, brutal, hypocritical and unequal system that has its now and its future in mind for the rest of us. And I think the war on Gaza has merely illustrated in the most stark way possible all of these features. Being an unremitting opponent of capitalism should mean, and I hope that it does mean for increasing numbers of you in this room tonight, that you will become a revolutionary socialist. But being a revolutionary socialist, as many people would know, especially the people who've kind of stuck it out for year after year, is not always easy. It actually does mean standing out from the crowd. It means standing up at work or at other places at risk of losing your job or of being threatened and of being criminalised ultimately. It means rejecting all of the dominant ideas, all of the laws, all of the ideological justifications, all of the obvious and subtle ways that capitalism is defended by the system around us. It isn't always easy, but it is absolutely vital. And I just wanted to finish by with a quote from one of the founding members of Matzpen, which is one of the Israeli socialist organizations. It never got very big, but it was quite a significant small organization for the kind of ideological position that it put out, especially after the 1967 war. And tomorrow morning, actually, we're having an interview with one of the members of Matzpen, Moshi Makover. And there's a really wonderful film, actually, that people should try and watch on YouTube if you can. It's about the history of Matzpen and about their organizing in this context of quite extreme repression and isolation. And one of the activists, Akiva Orr, said right at the end, he was quite old, and the filmmakers had obviously asked him to kind of reflect on his life and to say what he kind of took out of all of these decades of extremely difficult activism in the middle of what was undeniably and still remains one of the most violent and brutal states on this planet. And he said that all of the frustrations and difficulties were worth it. And because of that struggle, despite being a minority, that he had managed to live with dignity, with determination, and without shame. And because he refused to accept, he refused to go along with all of the things that society wanted him to go along with. To live with dignity and without shame at the end of your life because you've been a revolutionary socialist is something that I think we should all aspire to. And he said, "I see myself as a grain of sand in a mound of the solution." And if these last months, I think, have demonstrated anything, it's that it's absolutely vital for those grains to become more numerous and for the mound to become even larger. And I think that whole thing is part of the point of this conference. And so we invite you to join in a resistance, not just of the barbarism of what is happening in Gaza, but a resistance movement that can fight for a world that can honour the memories, like properly honour the memories of all of those children, all of those fighters, all of those lovers, all of those brothers, all of those mothers, all of those humans that have been cut down and had their lives stolen from them in the last 6 months in Gaza. And that world is called socialism, and it is what I want to urge you all to join us in the fight for.